Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change. This is part two of an interview and discussion with Sam Marchant of Ambro Perks. In part one, we discussed about the state of the investment community and what he looks for in investment.
So, could you explain a bit about pre-seed, seed, and Series A? Could you define those bits as you sort of see it? Because, you know, I see entrepreneurs and I see investors throwing around these sort of terms, and I'm going, no, I don't think you're seed stage or whatever. So, you know, Series A, could you explain what your definition of those sort of sections and that are?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I take it in kind of three ways. I think from a pre-seed perspective, it is I've spotted an opportunity, right? That could be I've started testing something with a group of customers, or I've built a closed Slack channel with 100 members now. They're all using this product. You know, they're engaging with it on a daily basis. I've iterated it. There's a business. I think there might be a business model appearing over here. That's very much that I've found an opportunity. For me, the seed phase is I have some sort of infrastructure or product or more developed thinking around that opportunity. So I know that if I took, you know, if I took a broad opportunity in the top of funnel, actually, I would only focus on, you know, parts one and two, because that's where I've tested the most and I've really found good success. And I know that with this product that I have now, there is the ability to scale that, and I can push that out. And then in Series A, it's ultimately the infrastructure that is there, so the startup that is there, the product that is there now needs big scale and big distribution. And I think, you know, now more than ever, investors are pushing the 1 million, you know, ARR or, you know, some sort of 1 million in terms of revenue figure at Series A. And you can kind of see how that on-ramps and how that builds. But ultimately at Series A, that's about doubling down on acquisition. And that's where you've got stronger signs of PMF are starting to come through. At the pre-seed stage, you know, everyone says, oh, we're investing in founders. And I think people really interpret that the wrong way, which is, oh, we're only going to invest in a white man who went to Oxford and was at this consultancy firm. That's not the case, right? What kind of characteristics and what traits do these individuals have? As I've spoken about already, you know, can they execute? Do they have an unfair advantage over the market, whether that be an intelligence play, a skill set play, a network play? You know, there's all of these things that kind of come in, and that's what you're really trying to figure out with founders at that stage. At the seed stage, it starts to become more, do we believe that this individual or these individuals could attract serious talent to this team? You know, are they aware of where their gaps are? But, you know, so what's their kind of degree of self-awareness, and who do they feel that they need to bring in order to kind of continually unlock value and scale this proposition? And at Series A, that kind of just amplifies through further as well, right? You know, the kind of Series A teams I'm seeing now are 35, 40 plus people roughly, you know, that are kind of there. And if you take those kind of figures, you say, okay, well, has this founder got the ability to step back and go from really executing and operating and being in the weeds to actually saying, no, I'm going to be really high level on this business here, and how can they drive the performance of all the individuals within their team? And I do spend a lot of time speaking with early stage founders actually about how do they think about their team's performance and how are they going to unlock additional value from those individuals, you know, in a way that is conducive for both parties. Like, you know, you want everyone to feel happy and feel like they're pushing themselves and moving forward and progressing. And the art of doing that is it is an art, and it is very hard to do. And some people have it and some people don't. I don't think it's as binary as that, but I do see when you get to Series A stage, some founders can often get a bit jittery and say, okay, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm ready to lead or do this. And that's where, you know, traditional venture capital was, okay, well, we'll bring in, we can bring in people or we can help you. I think with the volume of deals and volume of investments that have been made over the last five to 10 years, that has changed slightly. And it's, you know, and then if we start taking into account SEIS and EIS, you know, things are, can fail and can go down quicker and slightly softer, which I don't necessarily think is a good thing, but there we are.
Great points in terms of those stages, and as you've highlighted, there are different stages of the development of the product and the process. And also, I think you raise a great point there about the team size and the discontinuities that happen going from a two person startup to the smaller team, as you said, with about maybe a dozen people, then to go into the 40 sort of type people. There are some definite discontinuities in the change of management and style and people and that there. Now, this is fantastic, Sam. So look, we've gone through the stages of investment. Could we look at it from some different angles than that now?
Sure. You
know, tech areas that are interesting at the moment. So clean tech, climate tech, net zero tech. Mm. You know, what's your take on that sort of sector now? The, you know, software side and the hardware side. You know, we've got to do some hard things. We've got to build hydrogen plants, we've got to build electric vehicle infrastructure, we've got to build circular economy sort of type value chains. Yeah. You know, you touched on earlier, I've been working for many years now in startups and corporates, and to me it's about the changing value chain, and particularly in climate tech, we need to change the process. We need to make more money by consuming less stuff. So things like circular economy, things like green energy. So what's your take on the investment startups that are happening in that space?
It's a really interesting point. And I mean, look, I sit as a very generalist investor on the team here at HP. My amazing colleague, Laura, Andrew, you should do an interview with Laura. She's incredible. And she looks after the kind of sustainability vertical, sustainability investments that we do here at HP. But, you know, whenever I've spoken to her, one of the things that we do agree on, both of us, is that ultimately we can't solve this with software. Right. We just can't solve the climate crisis with just software. It needs to be hardware. We need to put things in the ground, in the air, on land. You know, these have to be physical assets, you know, machines, et cetera, that are ultimately going to be software enabled that can actually help tackle this crisis that we face. In order to do that, we have to get to a place where as investors, we are thinking about our returns profiles in a slightly different manner than we would be to comparing it to, you know, a B2B SaaS product, right? It's just non-comparable. And I think you can't say that, you know, we're going to try and tackle this problem with B2B SaaS and expect the outcomes that we want, because it's just not going to happen. And ultimately, I think that, you know, I'm not shifting the blame or shifting the kind of pressure point here. But I think what we do need to see is more LPs kind of demanding that actually know we are understanding of the returns profiles that come with clean tech and climate tech investing. If you are going to invest in hardware products, we understand that these things are going to have longer, you know, it's going to take longer than a kind of 5 to 10 year returns horizon for these kind of gains to be realized and for the value to be realized. Ultimately, that's what we have to do. We have an amazing fund here at HP called HPEP, which is our the Hambro Perks Environmental Technologies Fund, a Series B fund investing in this manner. So investing into IP-rich, hardware-focused businesses that we know take slightly longer to kind of not create value, but, you know, come up and realize any kind of gains and then distribute funds back. Because ultimately, it does just take longer for these businesses to establish themselves and for the proof points to be proven out. You don't have that kind of virality in distribution. You don't have those network effects. The flywheels can often be far slower and often a little heavier, so that they spin, but, you know, it takes a lot of effort to get them spinning. And I also think that there's a requirement for investors to shift into a deep tech mindset here. We have to spend more time reading, thinking, operating collaboratively to actually find suitable investments and support these companies in the best way. Because we are talking about having to totally radicalize and change our thinking here. We can't approach this problem with the thinking that we have to date. We have to try something new and really start thinking outside the box. So maybe that's a pretty vague answer to it, but I do believe that ultimately, the B2B SaaS play is just not going to work here. We have to understand that hardware, it needs to be invested in, and that these businesses are ultimately going to be slightly slower and require arguably more capital than the kind of B2B SaaS counterparts. But ultimately, if that's the goal that we're chasing, then we have to get comfortable with that, and we have to work with our LPs to do that.
I've been 20 plus years with working with large corporates and their corporate venturing, and been passionate about corporates involved, as you said, LPs, limited partners who are investing in funds so that they get to see where these technologies, these new business models are coming along. And ultimately, those corporates are the ones who I think have to change their business process, but hopefully learning from these startups. Yeah. So be it, biomaterials packaging business or a circular economy solution that brings back these sort of products. So where do you see corporates, can corporates be the part of that solution where you said that they've got more patient capital, they're the ones who can deploy the hardware and sort of stuff like that? So how do you see HP working with corporates or funds and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, there are kind of two points I have on this. In terms of HP's perspective in working with corporates, we work with some of the largest financial services or financial institutions in the world. We work with some of the leading innovators in technology, in sustainability, in climate tech. And the reason that we do that is because ultimately we have found a need that these companies have, and it kind of hints to the CVC model, right? Which is that, and you alluded to it just while we were chatting before hitting record here, Andrew, that ultimately corporates do need this technology. They they struggle to innovate. They struggle to innovate at speed and at scale. Yeah. And ultimately acquiring these technologies, whether that be actually by making an investment or by just bringing that technology in-house, is a good thing for the organization. We sit kind of in this middle ground between not only our portfolio companies, who are often looking to leverage technologies that some of these larger players have used, or trying to access their customer bases or even their teams, right? So we definitely sit at that intersection between those two. I think so that's my kind of first point. I think on the second point around corporate CVC and that opportunity, I don't think anyone has really gotten the model right yet. I know of one fund here in the UK that kind of sits very much between the startup ecosystem and corporates, and runs a number of different, I guess, accelerators or funds and channels to help those organizations. The issue with that is that you have a resource problem, but let's not talk about their business model and go into that in too much detail. But I think there are challenges there. Ultimately, what we're doing is we're asking corporates to change the way that they think. And one of the best, examples I have of this, I think, actually, is a friend of mine who works at Maersk Growth. So the Maersk, the large, very well-known shipping company. They do many other things, logistics, etc. Yeah. And he's not only a lovely guy, but he's incredibly ahead of the curve, I think, in terms of looking at emerging technologies. And that comes from his understanding of Maersk's underlying business model, the issues that they face, but then also understanding the needs of entrepreneurs who are building in those early stage startups. And he probably does it better than anyone I've kind of come across, where he's able to really take pain points on both sides. You have founders who want to test things with mass markets, or they want to test them with large customer bases, or they need a certain technology or resource to actually go away and figure things out. And Maersk, would have opportunities to unlock and create value within their own business, right? And these startups can help do that. So they are probably one of the best funds to do that. So I hope he doesn't mind me calling them out, but I do think they do it really,
Yeah,
really
no, but
well.
I think that's a good example of going out there and seeing new technologies in engines and design and software that could be used and just loadings and looking at the full value chain of that whole logistics sort of chain and saying, where can we change things, not just the bit that's maybe on the ship, but looking at the full value chain. Look, I'm going to pick your brains on one
Completely.
other topic, artificial intelligence. Now, back over 20 years ago, the late 90s, I was in Unilever. We didn't have email address on our business card, and I saw this dot-com thing and Netscape and Mosaic and thought, wow, this is going to transform, and we should put our products online, we should do order taking, we should do automatic replenishment. And I failed to get that in. So then I started a business to help corporates with their innovation and venturing. And artificial intelligence now, GPT, data, planning, this whole thing that's behind that machine learning, I'm now looking at that and thinking this is 10 times faster and have 10 times more impact than dot-com did, is my feeling at the moment. We're on the edge of this, whichever the curve or is going up or the precipice and going down, whichever way you look at it. What's your take on AI for startups and where these startups are going to be implemented in that now?
Yeah, it's true. It's a good question. So I'm in my family, I'm the black sheep. I'm the one who doesn't come from a technology background. So my brothers and my dad, they're all in technology. So when I give my views here, I know that when they listen to this podcast, they're going to be laughing. I guess first and foremost, my investment thesis around AI is actually largely driven by the fact that I think verticalized and proprietary models are going to win and are going to dominate rather than open source, especially with businesses and enterprise, right? And the reason for that simply just comes down to two things: privacy, and then also the tone of voice and the business experience that these organizations want to give their customers. So I believe that anything touching that, so infrastructure that enables that, is ultimately going to win. What I am seeing more now is obviously, increased deal flow of companies that are, leveraging artificial intelligence. A lot of those companies are at the application layer. They are essentially taking this technology, integrating it together, and trying to create value there. I think the issue with that is it can only go so far. Not having any unfair advantage over the proprietary technology that you've developed means that ultimately you're always going to be playing in a does the user think this is the best application of this technology? And ultimately that opens you up to kind of competition and to be, fighting constantly, which is something that, I think as from an investment perspective, we want the leaders in their fields to be dominating that because they have created, an unfair advantage in the technology that they've built. So that's definitely how I think about AI and deal flow. The last point I would say on this is that I'm seeing more what I call AI-enabled startups now. I think we're seeing more companies come through or coming to raise investment, and they're saying, well, look, I know I'm at the pre-seed stage or the seed stage, but ultimately I've got an AI that's running my kind of, building my top of funnel customer acquisition for me. I don't need to hire a salesperson to go and build that pipeline. I can run an AI to do it. Or, I've got an AI that's automating, all of my internal docs, writing all of these reports, building out my content strategy, building out my marketing strategy. And that is really quite powerful. It tends to be the founders who are building in this space anyway, so have some sort of product that is, AI enabled or, using an LLM, etc., that are using this technology. But I do think over the kind of next 9 to 12 months in particular, we will see a rise of companies coming out where it might be, two founders, three founders, however many founders it will be, and they will be largely supported by AI models that underpin, some of the very boring and mundane tasks that are needed to be done in startup land. And the reason that that's exciting is it means that founders can get back to doing the real magic thinking that we need for them to create serious value and tackle some of the largest problems that we have. If you said to me, okay, by using an AI, I can free up 10 to 15% of my time, and that time is then going to be allocated to spending it with my customers, or reviewing the product, or thinking about the opportunities in this space. As an investor, I'm thinking that's great. Like, that's a no-brainer. Do it, right? Because that's ultimately what you want founders to be doing.
And I think that's a great general point that there. The bit I'm interested in now, because I've played a bit and I've built some prompts and done some things and looked at particular sectors myself, and I'm shifting the thinking from, well, that's fine, AI is going to do that bit. What's the important bit that I do or the business is going to do to add value in that within that space? And I suppose a little scenario going back to the thing, what I'm looking for now, just as you talked about these founders are starting to do things with AI that we hadn't sort of thought about and are going to be better about. Thinking back to the early 2000s, the late 90s, is there a founder now who's saying, do you know what? I don't need bookshops, but I've got the biggest bookshop in the world because now I can put all of these books online and I can execute by just running down to the local bookshop and buying the book when somebody orders. Who are those individuals who are now taking AI and saying, I'm going to disrupt legal services, I'm going to disrupt health, I'm going to disrupt, health and nutrition? There's an AI startup I'm working with at the moment out of University of Reading. And fair dues to them. They've gone down, they've gone to a fitness shop, they've built an AI application to help people with their health and their nutrition and their sports sort of type stuff. And it's like, well, that's that sort of vertical application where they've got off their butts, they've been down there, they've spoken to the customs, they've spoken to the shop owners and sort of stuff like that, and they're building this sort of stuff. And that's the bit I'm sort of excited about, which goes back, I guess, to the first bit of the journey. This is a now a disruptive bit piece of tech that we're looking for the interesting entrepreneurs who've got the ideas, who can build the minimum viable products, and that is probably where we're at, isn't it? Look, Sam,
Totally, yeah, and I think it's I.
go on, Fit, you finish off there. Sorry.
No, I was going to say it's a hugely exciting time, and I think whenever we have these real big leaps in innovation, we're going to see incredible kind of startups and pain points that we live with on a daily basis, right? And we don't consider that technology could solve, come along and actually be solved. And that is incredibly exciting.
No, Sam, it's been a fantastic time talking with you. We've covered so much ground through the startup phases, what you're looking for, what the entrepreneur should look for an investor, and we've covered some interesting sort of tech and that as well. So thank you very much for your time and the discussion today.
No, thank you very much for having me on. I've very much enjoyed the conversation.
That was the end of part two. Go back and see on the feed for part one, where we discussed about what he looks for in investments and what entrepreneurs should be doing with their startup. Please give a 5-star like and subscribe for future interviews.